Gators Breakdown, the Gators Fan Podcast, because there's never a dull moment in Gator Nation.
The Gators Breakdown Podcast is ready to go. I'm your host, David Waters, and you can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. And joining me for this episode is co-host Will Miles. You can find him on Twitter at WillMilesSEC and his site readandreaction.com. Will, had our end of the year Harmonic Woods tailgate party over the weekend at Mayor's house, and one last kind of hurrah for the 2019 season, getting ramped up for the 2020 season for the tailgate group.
Yeah, man, I was a little bit jealous looking at the pictures you were posting on Twitter, but then you didn't respond to anything from about 9 o'clock that night until like 11 the next morning. So clearly they made sure you had a good time, which is pretty much the way those guys roll.
Yeah. It was a lot of good time. Everybody there enjoying themselves. It was called the Orange and Blue Owl. So, of course, Hawaiian themed and creative namesake there for the end of the year party. But yeah, everybody who listens incorporated with the Harmonic Woods, you know, I know many of you have stopped by to tailgate and say hello. You know, we'll do that again next year. Stop by, say hello there. But thanks for those guys to, you know, I've been with that group for about 2 years now, and as they call it, it's a tailgating experience. And so yeah, nothing like it. And the party was no exception.
Boy, absolutely it is. So I'm going to have to make it down there for a couple of tailgates this year, hopefully. And then if they'll have me and they do the wrap up and it's on a weekend, I'll see if I can't get down there again. But obviously those guys are great. They reach out when I write something that they appreciate, and we appreciate all the support they give us.
Absolutely. Will, did you watch any of the XFL?
I watched a little bit. I mean, that's one of those things where it's like I miss football, so I turned it on. But at the same time, this is the off season, and my family appreciates it being the off season.
Yeah, it was funny. We were at the party, and we'd had it on in the background at the same time as the Florida basketball game, and could kind of just tell the Florida basketball game wasn't going to go the way that we want. So we weren't going to let that dampen spirits. So everybody just kind of went on, partied on while everything was on in the background.
Yeah, well, the Vipers did get blasted. So there were a bunch of people.
Aaron Murray.
There were a bunch of people making comments about that. And it is kind of fun when you can hate watch a Tampa Bay team with Aaron Murray as the quarterback. So, yeah, I think this is – it was sort of the same thing with the previous league, you know, with the Apollos and Orlando, and they got quite a bit of support. And obviously because Spurrier was the coach and that didn't – the league didn't necessarily work out, but I think people appreciated having football around. I suspect the XFL is going to be the same thing, especially once they get into the playoffs and once they get to the point where there's like a championship run. I think there will be some people who will get behind it. But it's just like any new league, right? It takes a while to figure out who's out there, who's playing. But it did look like a higher quality of football than some of the startup leagues that we've seen in the past.
Yeah, from Gators that I've heard from over the weekend, Will Hill, Martez Ivy, Matt Jones, just to name a few guys there, of recent Gators that were taking place in games in the XFL this past week. And I'll keep an eye on it. Like I said, this weekend I'm kind of busy traveling and all that kind of stuff and partying with those guys. So I didn't get to watch too much, but I'm not going to go out of my way to watch it, but I'll keep my eye on it.
It's kind of like me watching the Pac-12. I mean, yeah. It's like if it's on, I'll keep it on. But I mean, it's not real football, so why bother?
They do have some cool innovations. I wish other things leagues would pick up on the transparency during replay calls, and you can hear the referees and the official in the replay booth hashing it out, discussing what's going on. That was pretty cool. Hearing some of the play calls, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, they got some good things going. So hopefully, it's something that can stick around in spring for those who want to watch football or even more football.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is one of the legacies of the original XFL is the camera that sits right behind the quarterback and gives us those views. And there are a few other things as well. So you know, I think you learn when you have an opportunity to be entrepreneurial and experiment, it's always a good thing. Sometimes you learn the hard way because people don't like it, but sometimes you bring some things to the fold that maybe a more conservative, established group wasn't wasn't willing to do. And, you know, hopefully the XFL provides some of that and also provides some competition, because to be honest, it's a good thing for the NFL to have a development league. It's a good thing if there are guys who want to get paid and don't necessarily want to play for free in college, or at least for a scholarship in college. And, you know, I think more football, the better, assuming that, that the quality is where it needs to be.
There you go. Well, you hit on something, and we'll move on. I'm really wondering who's going to be that first high school, that first young college football player that's going to take that leap and say, hey, I want to go make some money. I'm not going to put my health at, on risk for a scholarship. I think I can go make a name for myself better in the XFL than I can college football. So we'll see. I do wonder who that first player will be who will kind of take that jump. You know, the contracts aren't not everything. They're nowhere near NFL contracts. You probably are, actually, no, there's no probably about it. You're still going to get more notoriety, more publicity through college football. But if you're that first guy that's going to take that jump, then you'll already get the spotlight put on you just by doing it and by being the first one to do it.
Yeah, it'll be kind of entertaining, I suppose, to watch and see who the first person is. To be honest, as long as it's not Gervon Dexter, I'm fine with it.
Absolutely. If you're thinking about going to Georgia, go to the XFL.
Yeah, there you go. It'll three five stars. You've committed to Kirby. They should all go together to try to reduce the amount of hype that they have to deal with.
All right, there we go. Have some fun with it. Have some fun with it. Before we get to the rest of this episode, we got plenty to talk about. Of course, all these coaching rumors and all that stuff going around. We'll jump into it here with Tim Brewster, Charlie Strong. We'll also get into Will's latest article over at Read and Reaction on hitting on the transfer portal and what that means for the Gators now and moving forward. Also, Florida and Cal being announced as well. So plenty to talk about in this episode of Gators Breakdown. But before we get to all that, remember you can find Gators Breakdown on newsforjax.com/GatorsBreakdown. You'll find all the Gators Breakdown episodes there, as well as News for Jax coverage of the Gators. And if you missed all of our signing day coverage last week, go back, listen to that. Plenty we discussed there. Rate, review the show on all the platforms out there and on social media. Follow Gators Breakdown on Twitter and Facebook at Gators Breakdown. And remember, come see me at a speaking engagement for the Fighting Gators Touchdown Club in Gainesville on April 23rd. So if you're around the Gainesville area or if you can make the drive, you know, that'll be right after the spring game on April 18th. I'll be speaking April 23rd, so there'll be plenty to discuss. The rest of the schedule this spring consists of Gators basketball writer Chris Harry on February 27th. March 26th will be Coach Savage and head coach Dan Mullen on May 28th. So big headline from late last week, Will, was Football Scoop reporting that the Gators are hiring Tim Brewster, more than likely to take over the tight end coach role left by Larry Scott, and he took the Howard head coaching job. Well, I was kind of doing some research here, and the easiest way is to go and look at previous schools and stuff. He's not even listed on the North Carolina official site any longer. So, this is pretty much happening. The writing's on the wall from everywhere else. So, but look, this is also, a huge move in recruiting for the Gators, not just replacing a tight end coach. And even with a top 10 finish last week on National Signing Day, we all see where the Gators can still improve in the recruiting world. And the hiring of Brewster is a step in that direction to shore up some of the recruiting deficiencies on this staff. And we saw it when it was announced and this excitement from Gator Nation of getting a coach of Brewster's stature here. You know, this was a chance for Mullen to go out and make a home run hire. And he made the absolute best hire he could have made in this situation. And this was a power move. I tweeted it out when it was announced. Quote, I consider this a power move by Mullen to get Brewster because it had to take a lot to get him. It really did. Jimbo Fisher, his former coach there, now at Texas A&M, he coached with him for so long at Florida State. Jimbo made a recent run to get him back at Texas A&M, but he decided to stay at North Carolina with Mack Brown. And Brewster has a long history with those two guys and a more recent successful history with Jimbo. And now he's at Florida and going to be at Florida. So, Will, he did have one season of history with Mullen back in 2012, but he had much more of a history with Jimbo Fisher and Mack Brown. Mullen identified a problem, went and found the best possible solution here.
Yeah, obviously anytime you have an opportunity, and I think just based on the players reactions to Larry Scott leaving. Obviously, those guys love him. And so, you know, I think you do need to say that with the way Kyle Pitts has emerged and some of those things, that he's done an unbelievable job there. But at the same time, you look at Brewster. He's a longtime Mack Brown assistant. Mack Brown has been able to recruit at places like North Carolina, where programs don't typically recruit real well. Then he's also been able to recruit at Texas. And Brewster was a big part of that. I mean, just recently bringing in Sam Howell, he was a lead recruiter for him. He was a lead recruiter for Vince Young when they were at Texas. He's got former collegiate head coaching experience. He was the head coach at Minnesota for 3 years. He was a wide receiver coach under Mullen, so Mullen is familiar with him. He's got NFL experience with the Chargers and the Broncos. And with the Chargers, he was a tight end coach right when Antonio Gates was becoming a tight end there. And then I think the big feather in his cap is he was the recruiting coordinator and tight end coach at Florida State from 2013 to 2017, when the Noles were 11th in 2013 nationally, 4th in 2014, 3rd in 2015, 3rd in 2016, and 6th in 2017 on the national recruiting rankings. And again, sort of the thing I think Gator fans remember is he was the lead recruiter for Dalvin Cook there. So, yeah, he's a upgrade in terms of what Florida really needs, I think. I mean, I don't think anybody looks at the staff and says, hey, we need somebody who's better at X's and O's on the offensive side of the ball. I think we look at the team and say, hey, if they can get a couple of difference makers, a couple of five-star guys coming in every cycle, then Florida ends up in that third, fourth, fifth national ranking, ends up really sort of bringing equal talent to Georgia and Alabama, and all of a sudden now with Mullen coaching, you feel really confident that the team's going to get to where you want them to get. So I think recruiting was an area where Mullen has identified he needs to get a little bit better, and Brewster certainly improves that.
Yeah, a lot of that you hear. I'm going to kind of repeat in some of the bio that Texas A&M recently had of him. But Will, you hit it on the head. Relentless, ruthless recruiter. And those are the two best words, I think. Relentless and ruthless. Believe me. I mean, you follow this man on social media. He is ruthless on the trail. He's ruthless with opposite fan bases. I remember being so ticked at him all the time when he was on Twitter during his time at FSU because he didn't care. He gave the opposing fan bases if you dish to him, he was going to dish it back. So it was with North Carolina this past season where he was instrumental. Also, you mentioned Sam Howell, but Clyde Pender in this most recent recruiting class, he was instrumental in getting him to stick with North Carolina over Florida this past cycle. And Brewster was at A&M the year before with Jimbo Fisher as they both came over from Florida State. And, you know, following this comes from to his Texas A&M bio. As I said, North Carolina pretty much had cleared everything out Tim Brewster related on their website. So I found that kind of funny. But so, quote, an accomplished recruiter, Brewster helped build the Seminoles' top-ranked 2016 recruiting class, which featured 18 four or five-star rated players, as well as 13 Under Armour All-Americans and four U.S. Army All-Americans. Brewster helped the Seminoles recruiting class. Those recruiting classes rank in the top 10 of ESPN's 10 ranking all 5 years he was on FSU staff, including in the top five 4 times. Brewster was named ACC's top recruiter by ESPN and made 24/7 Sports top 10 recruiters list, and was among Rivals' top 25 recruiters as well. Brewster was, as you said, Will, big in flipping Dalvin Cook from Florida to FSU back in their time. That's the headline there from my perspective. Everybody remembers that. Everybody remembers how excited we were when Dalvin Cook committed to Florida and then watching him flip to FSU and put it on Florida his whole career at Florida State. And then, look, you mentioned his coaching prowess as well. You know, not only is Florida getting a good recruiter here, they're getting a pretty good coach too. He made they said Florida State made the tight end an integral part of their offense during Brewster's time in Tallahassee. Everybody remembers Nick O'Leary, 2-time finalist for the John Mackey Award, which is given annually to the nation's top tight end. He won the award in 2014, as well as consensus All-American honors. Left Florida State as a school leader in every category among Seminole tight ends, including receptions with 114 yards, almost 1,600, and touchdowns in 18. So, you know, that was with Brewster being his head coach. He joined Florida State's coaching staff in February 2013, following a stint in 2012 as wide receivers coach at Mississippi State under Dan Mullen, where he helped Bulldogs break several records as well. He was head coach of Minnesota Golden Gophers from 2007 to 2010. And he was an analyst for Fox Sports in 2011. He led the Golden Gophers to Insight Bowl in both 2008 and 2009. As Will mentioned, stints with the Chargers and the Broncos in the NFL. Before that, of course, with Mac Brown and at Texas and North Carolina. So a lot of coaching history there, Will. Mullen made great replacement hires. I mentioned this in the podcast last week. His replacement hire so far, going back to David Turner, Torian Gray last year, those guys paid dividends on the trail and on the sideline as well. And now Brewster. In reading that biography, here's the worry, I guess, Will, is how much Brewster bounces around. He's been a lot of places lately in his career, and flirting with other schools as well. As I said, he flirted with Jimbo Fisher and Texas A&M this past offseason as looking to go back there after only one season with North Carolina. It looked like he was going to stay there until Florida comes calling. He's going to come now and be a Gator. But hopefully, given his success recruiting the state of Florida, he likes that Florida State for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, he's a little bit of a mercenary, at least recently. But let's be honest. I mean, all coaches in college football are mercenaries in some respects, just because they move around so much. And, the coach may be out, and then they get, the whole staff gets fired, and they got to go find jobs. And sometimes, things just don't work out, or you butt heads with the head coach, and you have an opportunity to move up a level, and you leave. I mean, we saw that. Nobody would be talking about the nomadic nature of coaches if Grantham had taken the job as a defensive coordinator at Cincinnati, for the Cincinnati Bengals. We would have just said, hey, you went to the NFL. It's a good thing for your program. I think it's sort of the same thing here. Now, one interesting thing is it's not a lateral move to go from North Carolina to Florida, but it is tight end coach to tight end coach. So I suspect that coming into Florida, he's going to be playing an integral part in the recruiting aspect of things. But if you're Brewster, you do figure that he probably wants to get another shot at being a head coach. I mean, Minnesota isn't exactly the best place to be a head coach. I mean, PJ Flex had some success there, but nobody else really has. And, you figure he wants to get another shot, and just going back to Jimbo doesn't really give you that opportunity. Going to Mac Brown, where you've been before, doesn't really give you an opportunity to differentiate, to learn something different. And so you wonder whether this is maybe a 2 or 3 year stint for him, where he's going to learn some things that are a little bit different and then maybe get another opportunity. And again, if Brewster's getting opportunities 2 or 3 years from now, that's a great thing, because it means he's bringing in high level recruits, and it means Florida's being successful. And so getting guys picked off your staff is a good problem to have, because it means you've got a successful program.
Yeah, this is one Gator fans should be definitely happy with, especially given, I think, a lot of us think, the final step in making this thing elite is, shoring up just the deficiencies on the recruiting trail. And this is the home run hire here that Dan Mullen could have made, went out and did it. And, hey, look, we'll see. Hopefully it paid dividends right away on the recruiting trail. And the fast start, as we kind of discussed last week, with 2021 class already keeping that fast start going with a hire like Tim Brewster. Also last week, Will, many reports out there also saying Charlie Strong's joining the staff as a defensive analyst. I asked around more today after we heard late last week that he was still weighing his options before making a decision. I reached out again today. That is still the case. Charlie Strong has not agreed at all to be a part of Florida staff. Yet he's got the NFL options. He's already turned down different defensive coordinator jobs in college as well. So he's still weighing options. Nothing has happened there yet. That's not to say it won't happen. But as that's where it stands right now, Monday night, close to 9 p.m., still weighing some options there, not officially part of the Gators staff. But we don't have to go through Charlie's history at Florida, because it was about as good as you can get when he was defensive coordinator with Urban Meyer. That got him a job at Louisville right after that with great success, and eventually led him to getting the job at Texas. And that was kind of where it fell apart, Will. A complete train wreck there at Texas. Could never really get it going. 16-21 overall record. Gets fired in the last season. He goes 21-16 at USF before getting fired there. So, look, let me get this out of the way. I'd love for Strong to become an analyst this coming season, with all the flirtation of Grantham and other jobs, maybe eventually becoming the defensive coordinator if we're getting the same Charlie Strong that was here previously. I think that's kind of where we have to – I think that's where I'm kind of drawing the line there. If I know I'm getting 2008 Charlie Strong, then by all means, sign me up. But maybe I weigh too much what happened at Texas. I know there's some circumstances there that made it tough for Charlie to win there. But at a place with the resources and the recruiting base, much like Florida, He failed there. You know, I would have at least wanted to see where he could control, what he could control, and still have a great defense in that scenario. He knows that side of the ball. And, you know, I won't, you know, give Will Muschamp a whole lot of kudos. But for the comparison there, even though, you know, Charlie, yes, did beat him head-to-head 2012 season, but for as bad as the head coach Will Muschamp was, the side of the ball that he knew was still elite, and you knew it was going to be elite. He was recruiting that side of the ball to be elite, and no matter how bad that offense was, the defense was elite under Will Muschamp. Left two elite defenses after he left as well. So, you know, Florida was going to have some great defenses under Will Muschamp. Everything went bad for Charlie at Texas. And you know, to me, it's raised the question, and it's raised the question out there a lot on Twitter and message boards out there too. You know, has the game passed him by? I don't know the answer to that. But I do know, you know, 2014, his first year as a head coach there, 31st rank in giving up 23.8 points per game. 2015 fell all the way to 83rd in the country, giving up 30.3 points per game. And then in his final season as a Longhorns head coach, the defense still ranked 80th in the country, giving up 31.5 points per game. I mean, that's his side of the ball, and you know, just completely fell apart. In USF, the last 3 years, they ranked 41st, 97th, and 75th. In points per game given up on defense. So not a lot of recent success for Charlie Strong. You know, every situation is different. Doesn't mean he wouldn't have success as a good defensive coordinator. You know, maybe it was just too much being a head coach, not being able to solely concentrate on defense. I just caution the thought that we'd be getting 2008 Charlie Strong if he's eventually defensive coordinator again. As an analyst, it's a home run hire. Maybe just needs a rest, take a year off. You know, learn and mesh with Todd Grantham, trade some secrets. Both of them can do. About as nice of a guy as one can be. Holds a lot of accountability on and off the field for players. But I just kind of want to look at this from all angles, Will, because his name comes up a lot, of course, with his success at Florida under Urban Meyer. Anytime there's the thought of Todd Grantham going to take a job, especially this past offseason when Charlie Strong got fired, it was, let's go get Charlie Strong as defensive coordinator. And you know, just going and looking at recent history, to me, there's some caution there.
I mean, I guess. Nobody thought Strong was really a poor hire when he was dominating at Louisville. And it turns out having Teddy Bridgewater is a pretty good elixir for things that maybe aren't necessarily perfect on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, the comment you made about specifically that, you know, running a program is different than running a side of the, you know, a side of the offense or side of the defense. And Mullen is one of the few guys who is able to be the head coach and also be the offensive coordinator. And it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. And so you do wonder when you start splitting your attention, does that stuff start to suffer? I think one of the things you look at for when he was at Texas is that the recruiting didn't suffer. Texas was still a very good recruiting program when he was there. And then when you look at the 2006, 2007, 2008 seasons, he was the second best recruiter on that Urban Meyer staff behind Stan Drayton. He brought in 12 blue chip guys over those three years where he was the primary recruiter. So again, if you're looking at areas where Mullen may want to sort of shore up his staff, and even bringing in somebody as an analyst doesn't necessarily put them out on the recruiting trail, but it does sort of grease the wheels to bring somebody on full time if you're going to bring them on. But I think what you said is probably most accurate, that you sit there and you say, okay, a year to sort of take a deep breath, to participate, to sort of get your sea legs under you again and realize that the last 6 years don't define you, getting back to the types of things that you did in 2008 and even in Louisville through 2013. And you know, probably learn some things from his failures at Texas and USF too. I think that's one thing that we tend to underestimate, is that if a guy can change based on the failure he's experienced, then he's going to be better off. It's only when the guy keeps trying to do the same thing over and over and over again that it becomes a problem. And so that's really what you'll need to gauge is he willing to change as he gets new evidence and gets new data. And certainly I think having the challenge of somebody like Mullen and also Grantham there as well is going to be a good thing for him if he does end up at Florida.
Yeah, so definitely worth keeping an eye on there. We'll see. Like I said, we may May get an answer this week. I think we'll get some answers on some of these hires this week anyway. We saw all the change that went on in South Carolina and Tennessee today, and them making changes and analyst hires and all that. And we'll kind of see there some other names floating around out there, of course, for analysts and coaching hires as well. You know, of course, Corbin Bell's name's floating around out there too. Nothing official with that one. Still, I've heard it's not going to happen. Heard it is going to happen, but the latest I have heard is not going to happen there. Some other names, some other analyst positions out there may be floating around too. So we'll see where Florida decides to go with this. But never a dull moment, Will.
No, it's not. And again, I mean, I think you add somebody like Brewster, you add somebody, if you have the opportunity to add somebody like Strong, you do it. I mean, these are football lifers, guys who have a lot of knowledge and experience, and getting that sort of knowledge and experience imparted to the players is a big deal. So, the analyst position, there's an opportunity cost to hiring one guy over another, but I think Strong gives you a lot of knowledge there, and it's worth the risk, assuming that he wants to come. And I think that's part of it, is that there are probably other programs out there that would like to have him in capacities that are a little bit more robust than the analyst position. And it'll just sort of be a question of whether he's able to find one of those, and whether the price is right, and whether he thinks it's the right move for his career.
Yeah, I think Arkansas was one of the schools I had heard that went after him as a defensive coordinator position. Obviously, it looks like he turned that job down. As an analyst, I'd absolutely love it for a year. Like I said, I probably would warm back up to him being a defensive coordinator with that year off and kind of learning the program and learning the coaches and learning the players, all that. You know, I'd warm up to it. I do think there may be better options out there if it had to happen now. But you know, as an analyst, and learning these players and all that stuff, I think it would be a home run hire in that capacity.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to happen now, right? We still have Third and Grantham for one more year, and we'll I'm sure there will be calls. You know, that is the one thing.
There you go. Yeah, go ahead.
That is the one thing that maybe Florida needs to take into account, is that there's a segment of the Florida fan base that remembers Charlie Strong extraordinarily fondly.
Yep.
And when you bring in somebody like that, and if the defensive coordinator struggles, then it starts to get some noise in the program, and you know, who are the defensive guys listening to, and those sorts of things. And you always got to be careful when you do that, right? I mean, we saw that a little bit with Georgia and Fromm and Fields. I don't think there's any doubt that having Fields in there, you know, impacted Fromm in some capacity. And then obviously Fields leaves and you got a giant hole. Sort of the same thing, a little bit different, but you bring in a guy who's beloved as a defensive coordinator at Florida. You know, the first time there's a game where somebody goes 7 for 9 on third down, you're certainly going to hear the noise, or at least we will. And so you're going to have to deal with that. And that is one, you know, really the only downside to having Charlie Strong join the team.
I'm going to make a joke. Grantham calls plays on first and second down. Charlie calls plays on third down.
Well, we could have used that a few years ago when Nussmeier was the offensive coordinator. Should have had Nuss call first and second down, and then we could have had McElwain call it on third. Maybe they would have been like,
we'd have been better off if I was calling plays on third down when that was happening.
You got a lot of confidence in yourself, buddy.
With Doug Nussmeier? Yes, I do. But hey, here's the thing also. A lot of people are looking at this move as in, hey, look, it's probably just a matter of if, not when, Todd Grantham gets a job somewhere else, whether that be a defensive coordinator job in the NFL or if it's a head coaching job in college. And this is just a way to get Charlie in here, as I said, familiar with the program, familiar with the players, get back in touch with Mullen, learn, as I said, you know, that him and Grantham, I think, can share some things. They're both great defensive minds, and maybe it's just a way of working him in here to eventually take over the job.
Sure. I mean, Grantham hasn't made it a secret that he's looking for a head coaching position. And, you know, he was tied with the Mississippi State job for a little while. Obviously, he was tied with the job with the Bengals last year. So I suspect that if the right opportunity pops up and if he continues to have success, he's going to get a shot. And I mean, heck, if he does a good enough job next year that he gets a shot at a head coaching job, then great. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are always options out there. I don't know that necessarily you need to like lure Charlie Strong as his analyst to grease the skids for him to be the defensive coordinator, but certainly having another voice there and a familiarity with a guy that you could potentially put in that spot is a benefit. And, you know, the other thing is that we do need to be clear that you were earlier, but we do need to be clear that nothing has happened here yet. And so it's entirely possible Strong won't be here. And then, you know, this will be like the Chip Kelly podcast that we did a few years ago where it's completely irrelevant. But now that he's at UCLA, we just want to burn it because none of the stuff we said is true.
So. No. It was just, I remember the initial thing was, okay, I want Mullen, Frost, and Chip. Those are my top three. And then we get, hey, it looks like Florida's going to hire Chip Kelly. So, yeah, you're right. We had to do this whole episode on this is what Chip Kelly would look like as a Florida head coach.
So,
I'm glad it didn't come to fruition.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit hesitant to do too much prognosticating here. But I mean, again, because Strong spent so much time at Florida, not just, you know, he started as a GA like back in, you know, what, like 82?
Yeah.
83, he was a GA. 88, he was outside linebackers. Comes back, for defensive ends, 91 to 93. Then defensive tackles, 94. Then in 2003, comes back as a defensive coordinator. He's the interim head coach between Zook and Urban Meyer. Then Urban Meyer comes in, and he's the assistant head coach and co-defensive coordinator for multiple years. So, he's sort of lived that life where he lived in the gauntlet with Zook when the team wasn't doing very well. And he also lived in the highs with Urban Meyer when the team was doing outstanding. And so, he knows what that pressure cooker is. He knows what the crucible is in Gainesville. So he's not going to be surprised by it. And we know that he can stand up to it. So that's a big part of it too, right? Is having somebody who understands what they're getting into when they decide to take those positions. And I mean, things have gotten a little bit more intense over the past few years, but it was intense back in 2006, 2007, 2008. I mean, I was on campus when the Fire Ron Zook website was started. Mm-hmm. And so, it's not as though Florida fans have gotten more reasonable over time. And that's one of the reasons why it's so much fun, right? Is that they're as passionate as they are. But that is one of the challenges for guys who come to Gainesville to coach.
Yeah, I mean, he's dealt with passionate fan bases at Florida, passionate fan bases at Texas. And as you said, nothing is going to surprise Charlie Strong when it comes to off the field there. So, all right, we'll move on from here for the potential coaching hires. So look out this week. I'm sure Mullen wants answers pretty soon for what these guys are planning to do coming up soon. So, Will, let's head over to Read and Reaction. Your site there and the article you released this week and really hitting the transfer portal. And you titled the article to be The Power and the Risk of the Transfer Portal. And you've kind of hit on it last week in our signing day episode and a couple other times as well. We know the positives of the transfer portal, but there are some risks there that is taken. And, you know, after departures and adding in signees and transfers, you bring up, quote, and it's the first thing we want to hit on here in bringing up your article, quote, the Gators aren't too far from being at an elite talent level.
No, not at all. I mean, you start looking at the 24/7 roster rankings where they take number 5 stars, number 4 stars, number 3 stars, and add up basically a point total for the guys who are actually going to be on the roster. And Florida's probably going to end up somewhere in the 7 to 8 range next year, I would guess, based on sort of where they'll be and where other teams have been historically. And there's going to be a little bit more attrition from Florida's roster, I'm sure. So maybe that's kind of why I'm thinking they'll be 7th or 8th. But, you know, they're bringing in four or five-star guys with Brenton Cox. Then you got Gervon Dexter. And then you got Shorter. And you've got Lingard. And if those guys can all play, then all of a sudden you've had a significant jump in talent. But beyond that, we talked last week for the signing day episode that they're bringing in 17 4-star guys too. So they're adding 17, I think it's 17 4-stars and 6 3-stars to the roster. The blue chip ratio is going way, way up for Florida's overall roster talent. Now it's a little bit front loaded because there's, you know, 28 guys coming in this class, and they've had less coming in the last two, and they've had some attrition from the 18 and 19 classes. But at the end of the day, Florida is going to have a talent ranking that's very similar to a team like Oklahoma or a team like Notre Dame or a team like Auburn, and maybe even a little bit in front of those teams. And so with they've been sort of in the 14th or 15th range the 2 years under Mullen thus far. And obviously they finished in the top seven or top six of the AP poll both years. So what can he do with a team that's eighth in talent, especially with a returning quarterback? I think that's why everybody's excited about the 2020 season.
Well, and so because of this and because of attrition, and that was one big part you made sure to hit in your article, because it's absolutely a point of discussion that has to be brought up. The attrition in not only just the pure roster, but, you know, the recruiting classes the last couple of years as well. You know, it really needs to hit on the transfers he's Mullen's bringing in, that, you know, he also needs to balance the roster as to make up for transfers and their potential short time on the roster. You know, one reason it's hard to equate and throw transfers into the recruiting rankings is because you're not really getting the 3 to 4 years out of these transfers as you would a normal recruit. You know, there are players that hopefully set you over the edge when you feel like you're close to making something happen, like, you know, a run happen here. Florida's on the verge. Florida's close. 10 wins, Mullen's first season. 11 wins, transfers a big part of that in his first 2 years there for, you know, but, you know, a five-star recruit is worth more than a five-star transfer just because of the amount of time you could potentially use them. So, but don't get me wrong. You know, there's no one out there that has used the portal better than Mullen so far in making up for roster deficiencies that were left to him as well. You know, hopefully he doesn't have to continue to chase his tail there.
Well, I think that's kind of the point of the article is that, you know, you look at guys like Grenard who were brought in. I mean, obviously you can't make his without his 10 sacks and 16 tackles for loss. It's a completely different season, a completely different defense. You look at the 2020 season, you know, each of the guys that he's bringing in plug a hole. So Cox plugs the hole left by Grenard. Lingard makes up for Florida missing on five-star running backs this past recruiting cycle. And then Shorter and Jordan Pouncey, the other wide receiver transfer, really start to mitigate the departures of the wide receivers. So Jefferson, Tyree Cleveland, Josh Hammond, and Freddie Swain. So they're helping with those guys. But the point you make, I think, is the thing that we need to watch for in the next year. So because of all the transfers that have been brought in, Florida's used essentially, I think they are only using 24 of their initial counters for the 2020 class. And what happens is you get 25 each class, but then you can count back from the early enrollees. So because of some of the guys who were non-qualifiers last year, they had a lot of guys who as early enrollees in the 2020 class could be counted back, which is why they were thinking they were going to get 29 guys this class. So you look at this and say, okay, they use 24 initial counters, which means they can only sign 26 guys next year, which means that if they're going to have to plug holes with transfers, let's say they bring in 3 or 4 more transfers next year. Well, that means you can only sign 22 guys on the actual, you know, for the actual 2021 recruiting class. And you just can't do that sustainably over time. And the biggest thing is, you know, so you bring in a guy like Cox. Cox comes in, he plays lights out this year, and he used one of those counters in 2019. He plays lights out, and then you have to replace him the next year with a recruit. Well, that means you've used 2 counters over a 3-year period for him. Or let's say Lingard comes in, plays lights out this year, and then leaves for the NFL after 1 year. Well, then you used a counter for him in 2020, and you used a counter for him in 2021. So you've used 2 roster spots essentially for one position, you know, for those 2 different recruits. And this is something our old pal Bill Sykes has been in my ear about this a lot over the last couple of months, just talking about the idea that you got to be really careful when you're managing your roster this way. And people have, a lot of fans have said, you know, that the transfer portal is making up for deficiencies in recruiting. And in some capacity, that is true. But you got to be careful, because what it means is that your depth is going to suffer because you're having to use 2 of those counters for essentially one position over a couple of year period. Rather than if you brought in high school guys, even if they stay for 3 years, even if they go into the transfer portal, all those sorts of things, it gives you more time to sort of build depth and manage your roster. So the big thing is that there's obviously a reward with bringing in these 5-star guys. But there's also the risk. And the risk is that this is a high variance strategy, right? That it could turn out really, really, really well because these guys could all be lights out and Florida could have an unbelievable season in 2020. But if they all leave, specifically with the way the roster's constructed, there's going to be a lot of seniors leaving after next year. And there's going to be quite a bit of turnover, I would expect. And so then, do you have the depth to combat that? And typically, this third year is when you see that sort of and it's a natural thing in most coaching hires, where in the third year he's going to have some issues because the guy who was on his way out maybe didn't recruit quite as well as he should have when people kind of knew he was on the hot seat, and then he comes in and has a transition recruiting class, which is a little bit weaker, and it takes a little while to ramp things up, and in that third year you see a dip. Well, I think Mullen's probably going to stave off the dip by having some of these five-star transfers come in. The question is going to be, does that mean that the dip comes in year four or year five? Because at some point, you got to pay the bill for the fact that you're bringing in these guys and they're not guys who are in your program for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, and hopefully just, you know, going back to last week, you know, hopefully this – I mean, look, I know there were transfers in this class as well, but you know, even without the transfers, not counting those guys, this was a good base. This, you know, this pure recruiting class of last week, of pure high school recruits, was a good starting point. Now, you can't have what happened last year, and by spring, you know, Jalen Jones and Chris Steele's gone, and, you know, two of your higher-ranked recruits, so one being a quarterback, one your highest-ranked recruit overall in a class, you know, those the class that's got signed last Wednesday all need to be on campus in the fall.
Yeah, well, and that was one of Mullen's hallmarks at Mississippi State, is he really sort of was able to keep those recruiting classes together, and he hasn't been able to do that at Florida yet. Doesn't mean he won't be able to. It just means he hasn't yet. So, you know, the attrition in that first class is typically is something that's pretty typical. But again, you had Justin Watkins being dismissed from the team before he ever not had an opportunity to play. And then in this last one, like you mentioned, Jalen Jones, who's dismissed, and then you've got Huggins, who's dismissed. So there have been some a mutual decision to part ways, I guess, is the way to word it. But, you know, let's be honest. So I think from the standpoint of just making sure that none of that stuff happens with this particular class, yeah, that's important. But, you know, I said in the article, and I think this is the truth, is that I don't think that Mullen necessarily expected to use the transfer portal in this way. I think what happened is he had a lot of five-star guys who were available, and then he looked at the guys that, you know, the last two classes he signed, I think 20 guys in 2018. And then he only signed like 22 in 2019 because of some of the non-qualifiers. So he had the initial counters to really hit the transfer portal hard and was able to be successful with that. It's just not something that you want to do long-term. So if you see him still taking two or three transfers, if we're still talking about plugging holes 2 or 3 years from now, then I think it's a concern. You don't want to build your program. You don't want to supplement recruiting that is good but not elite with transfers continuously. I think what he's done is he's supplemented recruiting that's good but not elite now. And the question then is, are the hirings of Brewster and potentially Charlie Strong and maybe some other guys that they may bring in at some point, is that going to help them come into the elite of the elite recruiting? Because the reality is, you don't need a bunch of transfers to come in if you're recruiting at the level of Alabama or Georgia or LSU. You just plug in the next guy and you don't necessarily worry about the transfer unless it's somebody who's transformative, right? I mean, obviously Burrow was an important transfer for LSU and Justin Fields was an important transfer for Ohio State. And those are teams that are stocked with talent and up at the top every time. So it's not that you'd never take a transfer. It's just, you could be more selective if you're up at the top of the rankings.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the Justin Fields transfer ended up hurting Georgia, where they had to go out and get a Wake Forest quarterback to be their savior for this coming year. They're banking on that. So, yeah, and look, I don't want to – I think the transfers Mullen's taken so far have been absolutely needed, and that's exactly the way it needed to go. But as you said, Will, the long-term solution, I liken it to listen to – you know, if you listen to some NFL talk and – yeah, I don't. I hate to compare NFL and college, but you've always heard the old adage of building a team: build a team through the draft, not through free agency. And that's kind of the same way of looking at this as well. The better teams, you can look at the Patriots and what they did and how they kind of built their foundation for their team. It was through the draft, and that's how they were able to basically, you know, stack Super Bowls upon Super Bowls and all that. You know, it's teams with success. You built through the draft, built through recruiting, and not have to worry about incoming guys later on.
Yeah, I mean, the example I used in the article is that you know you buy furniture on credit or 12 months, same as cash, and then, you know, at the 12-month mark when you don't have the money, you go out and you get a credit card and you put that on a no-interest credit card, and then you buy yourself some time there. But eventually the bill comes due. And the real solution is you have to make enough money to pay the bill. And that's really all we're saying, is that, you know, these transfers are prolonging the ability of Florida to, and that's the other thing, is Florida's recruiting is getting better from from 18 to 19 to 20, the talent has improved dramatically, especially over the McElwain era. So it's not as though Florida is recruiting poorly. It's just that they're not recruiting at the level of Alabama, Georgia, LSU, and Clemson. And, you know, that's where we want to go, obviously. I mean, I think there was the map after signing day that showed the state of Florida was owned by Clemson. Mm-hmm. And that can't happen, right? I mean, the state of Florida needs to be a place where at least a Florida team wins the state, but you'd obviously hope that it would be the Gators who would win the state. So there's still some work to be done there. I think Mullen knows that. I don't think he's stupid. I think he knows how to manage his roster and how to construct it. But there's been a lot of talk from that I've seen on Twitter about using the transfer portal as the new way to recruit, that this is the, you know, Mullen playing chess instead of checkers. And in some respects, that's true. But I do think it's just something you got to be careful about, because it is higher variance. Because if a guy you bring in blows out his knee, you know, and that happens with a guy who's, you know, a high school recruit too. But if the guy that you're counting on to plug a hole blows out his knee, it's a lot more serious than the guy who came in and you have a couple of years to develop him. And, you know, you're expecting him to contribute as a sophomore, junior, and a senior, as opposed to these transfers who have to contribute right away to be worth the counter that you're using on them.
Absolutely. Yep. That's the way I look at it. And as we said, so far, Mullen's been able to hit on it pretty well there. So something to definitely still be excited for, just not a long term solution. I think you can still go get one or two, and like a lot of the top teams are doing, to set them over the edge there. But absolutely the right move so far for Mullen and company. Will, a couple more. Okay.
Well, I was just gonna say I'm absolutely not anti transfer, because as anybody knows, I was calling for them to bring in Burrow. So it's not that you don't bring in a transfer, it's that the guy has to be transformative. And that's that's the thing that I think is reassuring about bringing in these guys, is that they are five-star elite level athletes. Now they haven't necessarily shown an enormous amount of production on the field, but their pedigree says that they will. And you figure that under Mullen, he's going to get the opportunity to get them to a place where they'll be able to do that. So when you have an opportunity to get a game changer on the field, you have to do it, regardless of whether it's transfers. But, you know, if they start bringing in a bunch of three-star transfers to plug holes, we got to get a little bit worried.
All right, we have a couple more topics here before we sign off for this episode. And put it on over the – I think it was late Friday. I got the email from the University of Florida, and pretty cool here to see Florida announced sophomore defensive back Kyrie Elam is Florida's representative in meetings with the Southeastern Conference Football Leadership Council, covering in Birmingham, Alabama this past weekend. The Football Leadership Council was one of three components of the SEC Student Athlete Leadership Council. Two other components are men's and women's basketball, but the student athlete leadership councils were introduced for the sports of football and men's and women's basketball, which, in addition to the conference's longstanding student athlete advisory council, they provide student athletes with additional opportunities to engage with campus leaders and conference office staff. The council serves as a conduit of communication to the conference office in issues related to student athlete experience and student athlete wellness. Agenda items for the group this past weekend included meeting SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey, a review of NCAA and SEC legislative items, open discussion on topics submitted by members of the council, and engagement with football officials on rules of the game, student athlete referee interaction, and careers in officiating. So former University of Kentucky student athlete and three-time NBA All-Star Antoine Walker visited the group and led a discussion in financial literacy and education. So, Will, we know everything Elam did on the field this past year as a true freshman, played in all 13 games, five starts, including the last three of the season, second on the team with three interceptions, 11 tackles, four pass breakups, one of seven true freshmen in FBS to record three or more interceptions. All three of his picks come in the fourth quarter of games, including the last one that sealed the Gators' victory over Virginia in the Orange Bowl. Well, it's pretty impressive, you know, that Elam already has this stature on the roster and in the program. So a true sophomore that's Florida's representative at these meetings, you know, never mind what he's done on the field, but Florida looks like they have a pure, you know, good pure leader here, as if Mullen and Scott Strickland deem him to be this, as a true sophomore, be their representative in everything we just discussed that this council puts together. I think it really speaks to the type of kid and person Kyrie Elam is.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime you get this sort of responsibility this early on, it's an impressive thing. And I think it's particularly important for Florida with all the leadership that they're losing after this year. I mean, you got Felipe Franks transferring to Arkansas, but you've got Hammond and Swain and Cleveland and Jefferson, those guys at wide receiver who were really so selfless, you know, giving up their own stats for the good of the group and the good of the team. And if Elam is part of being able to continue that, then that's a big thing for the Gators, because that is one thing I think that, you know, will be a concern as we talk through the off season is where's the leadership going to come from? Because it was clearly the wide receivers and Franks who provided a lot of that leadership. And that doesn't mean that Trask didn't provide it. And that doesn't mean, and then P. Ryan, I guess, was one of the other ones, but you know, it doesn't mean that Trask can't provide it. It doesn't mean that it won't come from Trevon Grimes or maybe even Kyrie Elam. It just means there's going to have to be different guys, different voices in the locker room. And so it's a good sign to see that one of those voices in the locker room at such a young age is getting an opportunity to represent his team in such a high profile way with the SEC.
Well, when I tweeted that, I had no idea it would blow up like it did on Twitter. And it's just funny. I was just checking it to see if I could go back and see how many likes it got. And lo and behold, it was one of the last like tweets still. And I posted it on Friday and it recently still got light here on Monday night, 3 days ago. It's got 610 likes there. So I think Gator Nation really took a little bit of pride here in Kyler Elam and his being such a young player, a young kid, and already leading the Gators there in such a, I think an important honor of being able to represent his team, his university there, and figuring out a lot of the issues and things that they can talk about there with the SEC office and officials there to make a better relationship between student athlete officials, SEC officials, school, the conference itself, and all those things come together.
Yeah, well, it's important with all of the discussion and the legislation, actually, that's coming out about capping coaches' salaries and making sure that players can make money off of their license and or off their likenesses and those sorts of things. There's going to be some changes going on in college football over the next 5 or 10 years. And in order for college football to survive, they're going to have buy-in from the players. And that's one of the things that I think is important is that they're hearing the concerns of those guys and hearing sort of what they go through. I mean, anybody who's ever spent any time with a football player while they've been in college understands that those guys aren't real students, that they've got responsibilities. It's essentially a job. And, so it's a good thing that they're giving those guys representation. It's a good thing that they're talking to them about financial literacy. And Antoine Walker may even be the perfect guy to do that because he struggled so much with it when he was in the NBA. And so can really speak to it from a perspective of learning from sort of, learn from my scars type of discussion. And so you see that a lot with young guys who get a lot of money very quickly. And, the only downside to this is that as good as Elam has been, and with the leadership that he's showing, I suspect he's only got 2 more years.
Yeah. And let's not forget, this is basically, you still could consider him a true freshman at this point. The season just got over with there. So, but when the season rolls around, be a sophomore there. So a lot of good coming from that. And lastly, Will, here we go. Gators will officially meet the Cal Golden Bears. We got a little bit of time for this one, though. 6 more years down the road, but they've officially announced. We've kind of known about this for a little while, but we'll meet the Cal Golden Bears in 2026 in Gainesville in 2027, all the way to Berkeley there. So Cal's visit to Gainesville will come on September 19th, 2026, with the Gators' return trip to Cal on September 4th, 2027. So our early season matchups there. Well, we know, FSU's a given every season, but I hope Gator fans have their frequent flyer miles ready to go in the coming years, because the Gators in their non-conference schedule, not so far, right? And that USF in 2021 and 23, but then you got Utah in 2022 and 2023, Miami, so you get to save some flyer miles there, 2024 to 2025, then Cal in 26 and 27, Arizona State in 28 and 31, and Colorado 28 and 29, and Texas in 30-31. All that over the next dozen years or so. So in the meantime, most of us have watched Gator football, and we haven't got to see games like this following Florida football. It was at the Harmonic Woods party this past week, and I was in Mayor's, Robin Martin's, his Gator room all decked out. And there's a section where he has a couple of pictures, and you actually saw some of these, Will. He sent them to you. There was a couple of pictures there of Florida playing and beating USC in the Swamp in 1982. And so how cool must it have been to see Florida and the Trojans matched up in the Swamp, and then Florida traveling to LA the next season and tie the Trojans in a game. You know, these programs, except Texas, don't have the history. And there's other schools here, and we've known about these matchups for a while, but now they're official, and it's going to be fun to see the Orange and Blue invade these towns and all their fan bases coming to the Swamp. If I had to rank them based on the games themselves, just the football side of it, you know, top three probably Texas, Utah, Miami, with the way it stands right now. If I'm basing it on destination, I think a lot of fans are looking at it in that as well. I think that one's a little tougher here, but I'd probably go Utah, Colorado, just to kind of see some different scenery, the mountains surrounding there, and probably Miami again, just because Miami's fun to hang out in.
I don't know, man. Tempe's pretty nice, depending upon the time of year. Now, yeah. If you're out there in like September, I'm not sure that's necessary.
It probably will be. But
I think obviously one of the challenges with bowl games is that you sort of see the same opponents over and over and over again. I know this year, if Florida had played Michigan, we might have had like three people watching just because nobody wanted to see the Gators play Michigan again. And some diversity is good when it comes to understanding where your program stands. And from recruiting, I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about going out to the West Coast. If you're playing out there, all of a sudden it makes the recruiting maybe a little bit more nationwide because, you know, a kid from California who's going to get to play out in Utah and then Berkeley and then Arizona in his, you know, 3 or 4 years at Florida, maybe takes another look at the Gators just because, hey, I'm going to get out west and have an opportunity. So, I mean, I think obviously Texas is a big one, but Colorado's a cool place. Anybody who's ever been to Boulder, that's a cool place. And looks
Ralphie,
like
Ralphie, you can see Ralphie.
It looks like a cool stadium to catch a game. And certainly there's some things that are legal in Colorado that aren't, that fans might be interested in. Out of Berkeley, you got the same thing, man. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, I think it's a good thing to play it's a good thing to test yourself. It's a good thing to sort of get out of the criticism that Florida's had over really the past decade or two decades of just, you know, never playing non-conference opponents outside of the state of Florida or outside of the Southeast. And, you know, I think this gives you an opportunity to really set yourself up. And is one of the questions about the 2020 season actually is that the non-conference schedule is so bad coming up that Florida is going – the question will be is if Florida slips up, particularly against LSU or Georgia, but let's say still wins the SEC or something, there's going to be some harping about the quality of the schedule compared to some of the other teams that are out there, particularly with the Pac-12 playing non-conference games. So it's a good thing to strengthen your schedule. Strickland, I think, has heard the noise loud and clear that that the fans aren't necessarily interested in just going to cupcake after cupcake after cupcake. And you know, they make more money off of TV than they do at the gate anyway. And so these are going to be made for TV matchups. And hey, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, especially if it's, I mean, I don't think anybody would argue that starting the game this year with Miami was a heck of a lot more fun than starting the year with Charleston Southern.
And I know it was on this podcast.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I mean, I think fans felt that way, right? You knew where you stood. And obviously, if you'd have lost that game, you know, the 2017 game against Michigan was sort of a deflating loss. And I'm sure Miami felt that this year when they lost to Florida. But winning that game sort of springboards you into feeling like it could be a special season and gets everybody amped up. So I think you have the opportunity to do that. And Florida's going to have an opportunity to do that basically every year from 2021 on, and so it's exciting to see that.
Well, you mentioned something we haven't really mentioned it here on this podcast. You mentioned TV money meaning more than the gate money and all that, and that's kind of, you know, well, that'll finish up our conversation on the upcoming opponents in the next 12 years or so. But we never really hit on the report that's been out there now for at least a month or so of CBS not basically re-upping with the SEC, and the SEC now being pretty much owned by, not really owned, but the TV rights being owned by ESPN, ABC. We'll have to say goodbye to the CBS theme song. I think that's the part mostly everybody's mad about. They won't get to hear that theme song anymore. That is a CBS song, not an SEC song. So CBS will keep that if they decide to stay in the college football world. But you know, we'll see. I mean, SEC Network's already ESPN, ABC branded entity anyway, up in Charlotte, in the same building as ESPNU. So there's already so much marrying and loving of the SEC and ESPN all together. But now it's going to get ramped up even more, where you won't be able to watch an SEC game that's not branded by ESPN, ABC. So we'll see. Of course, that CBS game at 3:30 was made so popular in the 90s and the 2000s, and all the, you know, the Florida Georgia game, and always 3:30 every year, and then LSU Auburn or LSU Alabama night games, and the LSU Florida night games that we remember during the Tebow years, and or basically the Urban Meyer years there. And a lot of people don't necessarily care for Gary Danielson and his analysis. I don't mind him so much, but I get the ire there. But you know, the years of CBS and Vern Lundquist calling the games and all that, we'll have to, looks like in the coming years, have to say goodbye to that. But it is interesting. You mentioned all the TV dollars there, and it looks like in a couple of years, we'll have to say goodbye to the SEC and CBS.
Yeah, I mean, I've already missed Vern since he's not on anymore. I mean, it's hard to really get into an SEC game without him butchering somebody's name along the way or not knowing what yard line they're on. I mean, that was always sort of fun. I think Danielson, I mean, whatever, it's fine. Like, I just hit mute when I don't want to listen to it. And so it's, you know, I don't necessarily, but the theme song is something that when that theme song comes on, I just remember Peyton Manning not being able to beat Florida at 3:30. You know, I mean, I was a kid in Indianapolis watching those games because I hadn't moved down to Florida yet. And still you're sitting there and it's just those games that where it was raining in Knoxville and raining in Gainesville back to back, where Florida's, you know, coming back with something like, you know, 45 straight points or something in one of those games. You know, those are sort of the things that you remember and sort of your indelible image of the two programs and Spurrier's fun and gun and that sort of stuff. So, I mean, at the time, as an outsider looking in, that's sort of the indelible image that I have. And really sort of, I mean, my dad went to Indiana, so he had a lot of inferiority complexes. But the inferiority complex there was sort of Ohio State was the big bully. But, you know, you knew at the time Ohio State couldn't compete with the SEC even back then. And that's sort of proven out over the next three decades. So, yeah. It's sort of a changing the guard. It's one of those things where I think everybody sort of presumed that ESPN was going to be able to. I mean, the SEC Network sort of set the stage for them to take this over, and really that it's a more valuable entity for ESPN than it is for CBS. And so, you know, it's a change. Change isn't always good. Sometimes it's uncomfortable, but as long as the Gators are on, I'll be watching. So ESPN is going to get what they want.
And the good thing is the SEC schools will get a lot more money dealing with this, because CBS was getting away with a cheapo contract that they the conference. And hey, look, CBS, I don't blame them whatsoever. It was a contract the SEC signed, and they had to live up to their billing of it. But the SEC in just a couple of years will be raking in. Like I said, I just brought this up. I'd have to go back and look at the official number of what they think will happen, what the deal will be. But SEC schools will be getting a whole lot more money coming up in the next couple of years.
Well, this is good. I won't have to create another fake email so that I can get a trial of the CBS app when I'm on the road for the like one game of the year when I'm not at home and I can't watch it and they won't let me stream it from my cable box. So, you know, that was definitely what one that that caught me off guard when Florida was playing Auburn this year, and I couldn't get it on my app for my home phone, and I'm like, or from my home cable, and I'm like, what's going on? And I had to sign up for their app. So I don't know what CBS is doing. It's one of the interesting things about sort of the football ecoverse, right? I mean, CBS lost the NFL for a very, very long time and sort of allowed Fox to build themselves up as a competitor. ESPN obviously has become the behemoth in this space and has really focused in the last year or so to getting back to the games and getting back to just owning property. And obviously in a DVR world, that's valuable, and it's valuable to Florida and the rest of the SEC. So yeah, they're going to be making what, like six or seven times as much money as they were before. Which means if you're one of those people who hate watches the SEC and thinks everybody's biased against them, just wait, because they're only going to get better.
I think the biggest thing will probably come out of it, we'll get a lot more of the big SEC game of the week being in primetime instead of always, you know, being at 3:30. That will probably be a change. I think they'll keep that 3:30 window too. I don't think they'll always put that top game at 8 p.m. there. I think they'll flip-flop that 3:30 a.m. slot, but that's just something to look out for.
Yeah, we'll just have to keep that in mind when we're scheduling when we're going to do stuff, because it was pretty obvious earlier this year that, you know, the Tennessee game was going to be at a certain time, and you could always sort of count on specific games throughout the year being at 3:30, and yeah, you were going to have some time to do stuff for the evening. So won't have that anymore, but you know, there's also nothing like a night game in the Swamp. There's nothing like a night game in Death Valley when Florida's going in there. And you know, that's sort of, if it makes the product better, it makes the teams better, makes for a better experience, I'm all for it. I just sort of, you know, my proclivity is that I hope that the players get to share in some of the spoils that they're generating with these new TV contracts. But you know, we'll see. The legislators are starting to push that, and we'll see where that ends up.
All right, one big part of what everybody was saying is, means, hey, maybe that means we get a night Florida-Georgia game. That ain't happening. The city of Jacksonville does not want a night Florida-Georgia game. I was at the last one, and it was a scene to behold. I don't think that the city doesn't want it. The universities don't want it. You'll see the game at noon before you see it at night. It will not. The city, it just won't happen. As it currently stands right now, a night 8 p.m., 7:30 p.m. kickoff for Georgia is not happening.
I look forward to playing this back when 3 years from now. Yeah. And I'm like, I thought you told me this would never happen, Dave. You're like, well, it turns out when you pay somebody an awful lot of money, they figure out how to make things work.
Yeah. If they do, you might see the National Guard there as security just to make it happen.
I mean, Jacksonville isn't that bad a place. Come on, man.
No, it's not. It's really not. But when you put those two fan bases together, when it's already a sight to behold when the game starts at 3:30 and you just add 5 more hours of the drinking, it just, I mean, come on, you know what it turns into.
Oh, I know exactly what it turns into, which is part of why I'm so in favor of it. But, you know, hey, the world's largest outdoor cocktail party is aptly named for various reasons and different levels of debauchery. I have no doubt that an 8 o'clock game is probably not in the best interest of anybody but the people broadcasting the game. But the people broadcasting the game will be the ones who win. So, Jacksonville ain't going to get what they want on this one, man. If ESPN says 8 o'clock, they're going to jump.
All right. Well, what you got coming up on Reading Reaction?
Yeah, so my new writer, Nick, he started out with an article about the Charlie Pell era, and he's got a couple of things coming up this week. He started writing the article and texted me today and told me he's going to have to split it into two because he had 8,000 words written about the 79 season. So I think some people have enjoyed seeing some of the older teams brought in. And, I mean, these older teams really set the stage for the Spurrier years and then the Meyer years. So it's been an interesting history lesson for me as well. So we'll have a couple of things on there. And then one of the things I'll probably write in the next week or so is I have been charting Kyle Trask over the year when he came in, and I think there's some interesting things to look at there and understand where he can take some steps forward and where we might not expect him to take steps forward. So that'll be coming in the next couple of weeks as well.
All right, that's Will Miles. You can find him on his site, readandreaction.com, and on Twitter at Will Miles SEC. I'm the host of Gators Breakdown, David Waters. You can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. Guys and girls out there, thanks for listening to this episode of Gators Breakdown.